Hi, and welcome to my podcast, Jack to the Future. From science and inventions to pollution and recycling, I talk about what's changing in the world, the future, and how we can help with that. Every month, I'll talk about a different future theme. For example, the future of science, tech, sustainability, reading, music, and all sorts of other ones. The future of everything. Did you know? You can find me on Facebook and Instagram as Jed to the Future, and on YouTube as Jack to the Future. Follow me to get behind the scenes info, access to the previews about my next episodes, and much, much more. This week's episode is about the future of space. I talked to Doug Millard, curator of the space exhibit at the London Science Museum. We talk about Doug's job, his favourite out-of-this-world object in the collection, as well as the future of spacecraft and how they could be greener, whether we'll eventually holiday in space, and the wackiest of activities that have taken place on the International Space Station today. Space, the final frontier. Heard of that expression? If you like Star Trek, you definitely will have. A frontier is a line or border, usually separating two countries. So the idea here means that space is the last and ultimate place for humans to cross to be able to explore new worlds. In space, there isn't really anything for us humans. No oxygen, no buildings, gravity, and because this is a podcast, it made sense to talk about sound. Since there isn't anything to conduct sound waves in space, many people think that sound does not exist in space, but there is actually sound in space. It just exists as electromagnetic vibrations. NASA have recorded these vibrations for all of us to hear. Here's a sample of the space sounds. Hey, so the future of space. Maybe it's that podcasts can be projected into the galaxy for everyone to enjoy. What else? How about staying at an orbiting space hotel or an inflatable habitat on another planet? Sounds far-fetched, right? But actually, these things are already being developed. The dream is no longer out of this world. An American company, Bigelow Aerospace, makes habitats that are designed to inflate once in space. These would give astronauts extra space to roam around and might mean that we could go to other planets where there is no oxygen, and the astronauts wouldn't necessarily need spacesuits on as long as they're in their special habitats. The company already has one of its test habitats in orbit right now, which has been attached to the International Space Station since 2016. I'm holding out for a spacecraft in the future that travels faster than the speed of light, at warp speed to other galaxies. I think I may be waiting a while. A little fact for you here, in 2013, some physics students from the University of Leicester actually showed that the special effects shown in films like Star Wars when spaceships fly at the speed of light and you see long strips or streaks of bright light are not actually true. Passengers on the Millennium Falcon actually wouldn't be able to see stars at all when travelling that fast. In fact, something called the Doppler effect would happen, which would cause a bright glow in the middle, and you definitely need sunglasses and something to protect you from harmful X-ray radiation. The spacecraft would also need extra energy to counteract the force from the radiation from shifted starlight. Not that easy to achieve then, and maybe not something as exciting as it first seemed. Eek! Any children listening, you may want to be an astronaut when you're older, and for any adults listening, maybe you did when you were a child too. Maybe you even became one, so I'd love to hear from you. Message me on social media or voice message facility on Anchor FM. Whoever you are, what would be your dream for the future of space? I'd like to welcome today my special guest, Doug Millard, who is the Deputy Keeper of Technologies and Engineering, Space Curator at the London Science Museum. How cool is that? Thanks for being here today, Doug.
Hello, Jack.
Hello.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jack. Nice to be talking to someone who has such an interest in space.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Thank you. What does a curator in a museum do?
Well, that's a very good question because it's not obvious, is it? But maybe I'll speak about three things which we do. Now, a curator is a type of word we call a noun, but you can also have a different sort of word called a verb, which is a doing word. Now, to curate, you look after collections. Now, I can see that you've got some collections of items on your windowsill. You've got a fine model of a crane. The Science Museum has many, many collections. We have about 150 different collections dealing with all of science, technology, medicine, mathematics, all the STEM stuff, in other words. So what we are required to do, we actually are required to do it by the government, is to add to the collections and to care for the collections. And this is so that people in the future, as well as today, have a chance to look at some really important objects. I can give you an example of what I did last week. I added to the Science Museum's space collection when I bid at an auction. I don't know whether you know what an auction is, but it's when people sell items to whoever bids highest price for the item. So I actually took part in one of those and added a telescope to the collection just last week. Another thing the curators do is display them. So we create exhibitions and we create galleries where we can put just some of these collections on display so that you can come and visit the Science Museum and see some of these objects. And then the third thing that we do is we try and understand the objects, the collections. Why are they important? What do they tell us? Do they look good? Yeah, fine. But what if they don't look very interesting? Are they still important? And then that helps with the displays. We do lots of other things, but those are the top three, I would say.
That gives me a lot of information about what a curator does. So thank you for explaining it to me, because some of the words, I did not know what they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, always have a dictionary. It's one of the most important books you can ever have.
Yeah, it is. I've got probably quite a few of them at home. My dad has one that from when he was a child that is like so big. It's like thousands of pages long.
You can tell your dad, I also have, it's a very small dictionary. We all had to buy one in school, which was a long time ago. And it's still got my writing from when I was 11 years old in the front cover.
How hard is it to find objects to display in your exhibition?
Oh, that's an even better question. Well, for a subject like space technology, it's actually quite difficult. There are other collections which are far easier. So, for example, one of my friends at the museum, another curator, she looks after the collection of domestic technologies. So that would be refrigerators, cookers, washing machines, things like that. So they are far easier to collect because there's so many of them. But space is hard. So it's all about keeping your eyes and ears open to spot any opportunities. Sometimes we actually ask people who work with space, have you got any spares? Or have you got maybe a model that you made when you were working out how to launch your mission? Okay, so you'd have a model that's not the final spacecraft, but one on the way to becoming the spacecraft. And then sometimes people contact us. So I might get a phone call from someone who works in a satellite factory, for example. Now, you may already know there's a very important one in your county, in Stevenage, where they make satellites. It's called Airbus Defence and Space.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
We're going to interview a person from there.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that's a very important centre. They even build things that go to Mars and the rest of the solar system. So a really exciting place. And if they have something which they don't need anymore, they may phone me up and say, Doug, would you like a flight spare for the Bepi Colombo spacecraft? I say, oh, yes, please. And then if you remember, at the beginning, I talked about an auction. So I have to keep an eye on sales, on auctions, when spacecraft or bits of spacecraft come up for sale.
That sounds really cool.
Jack, do you like drawing or painting or sketching?
Yeah, I really do.
Yeah? Okay. So I can tell you about the one I bought about 2 years ago. It was before COVID, before coronavirus. And that was a notebook which astronauts kept when they were in space. And it included a few sketches of the sunrise. When you're in space going around the Earth, you usually go around about 9 times a day. So that means you see 9 sunrises. It's a bit difficult to think about. And these astronauts actually drew what they saw. It's very beautiful. And I think if you have a look on the Science Museum's website, you may be able to find a reference to that particular item. If you can't, then let me know and I'll send you a picture anyway.
Cool. That sounds cool. Is it a little bit like constellations, but like with a drawing?
It's a bit like a sunrise. So if you were to draw the sun right, you'd have to get up very early, but you'd probably see a red to begin with, a big red sun on the horizon. And you'd see the sky would be coloured as well. And that's what you see in space. You actually see the sun rising above the horizon of the Earth. So the curvature of the Earth, you can actually see the sun coming up, and you can see a very thin blue line between the edge of planet Earth and space, and that's our atmosphere. It's very thin, it's not very thick, so that's why another reason we have to look after the atmosphere, because it protects us from space, and that's what the astronauts draw.
Yeah, I got a bit mixed up when I said about constellations. I was thinking of stars for a second,
No, it's a good point about stars, because the astronauts on the moon, when they were not in sunlight, so if they were in shadow, so for example, if they were standing behind their lander in the shade, they looked up, they could see millions and millions and millions of stars far more easily than we can, because that wonderful atmosphere we were just talking about, which protects us, it also makes looking at stars a lot harder.
Oh, wow. I really like to see that. What I mean is, I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Because, well, maybe in the future, I'd be able to.
If you really want to, you know.
Thank you. Some people end up doing a completely different job from what they actually wanted to do from when they were a child.
You never know. Again, keep your eyes and ears open. Work hard and keep your eyes and ears open. You never know what might come your way.
What's your favourite out-of-the-world object in the exhibition, and what's the most popular with visitors?
Ooh, that's a tough question. It's always difficult, you know, name your favourite. I've got quite a few. An out-of-world object, one I'm very fond of, because I had to bring it from America to the Science Museum, and that's a piece of the moon. It's a bit of moon rock, which the Apollo astronauts, I'm sure you've heard of Apollo.
Yeah.
That was the program that put astronauts on the moon all those years ago. And one of them brought back a piece of rock. It was called Great Scott, because the astronaut that found it was Dave Scott. And he spotted this big rock on the moon. He said, oh, I think we'll have that.
Like Back to the Future too.
Oh, yes. I watched it in the cinema when it first came out. Terrific film.
When Doc Brown says, Great Scott, 1.21 gigawatt.
A lot of power.
Yeah.
On the moon, rocks weigh far less, so he was able to pick it up fairly easily and put it in his little rover, his little car, and that was brought to Earth. And then it was cut up into smaller pieces, and I was able to borrow for the museum one of these pieces to put on display in the space gallery. But they couldn't post it. They couldn't send it by airplane or anything like that. You had to go and collect it. So that was quite an adventure. I think another one would be one which actually didn't make it into space, which meant it could come to the Science Museum fairly easily. And that's a British space rocket, which you can see in the gallery as well. It's called Black Arrow.
Yeah.
And that was actually built on the Isle of Wight. So I don't know where you go for your holidays.
I did go on holiday to the Isle of Wight, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I was very young, so I probably wouldn't have known what the Black Arrow was then.
Well, you may not have been to where they used to build them.
Yeah, but probably wouldn't.
If you go back, the actual rocket was built in a town called Cowes, which is very famous for its yachting. But if you go to the far end of the island, that's where you can look at some rocks in the sea called the Needles. And if you just walk over the brow of the hill, you can see where the Black Arrow rockets were test fired. So that's when they lit them, they fired them up, but they didn't let them take off. So they were just testing the engines. And you can still see where all of that was done. So maybe you need to go back to the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, I think that'd be cool if we did. Yeah.
So those are just two favourites of mine.
Those are probably all of my favourites too, because I love sort of rocks from different planets. That's very specific, but I still do.
And it's old. It's very old.
Yeah.
It's not even millions of years old. It's billions of years old.
Yeah. You could say it was from the 1960s, but that's not true, because it was, the moon was far more before that. But it was collected in the 1960s. You have a replica of Eagle, which is a lander that took Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the moon in 1969. You also have on display a replica model of the Beagle 2 Mars lander, which is more modern. What are the differences that you can see between the technology from now and back then?
There's a fairly easy answer. Once you've worked out how to land on the moon, for example, or in the case of Beagle, how to land on Mars, then the design of both spacecraft, that doesn't really change a great deal, even if there's many years between them. So they're probably going to look the same. You know, a 21st century version would look fairly similar to the 20th century version. The big differences, though, are that the parts of the landers, they become smaller. So we're talking about the systems, the electronics, the components, the units.
Yeah, that's because we can fit more like parts into them nowadays.
Yes. And of course, the big one is computing. So computers today are far more powerful than the computers that Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin went to the moon with in 1969. You've probably heard that the amount of memory that you have in a calculator, if you have that, or a watch perhaps, or a mobile phone, is far more than the astronauts had in their computer to go to the moon. So the big difference is the bits of the computer, which means you can get more of them in the spacecraft, which means that they are more effective. I would say the other main difference is the type of material. So metal is usually fairly heavy, but we know metal is strong. We build airplanes out of metal. We build cars. We build spacecraft out of metal. But there's another material which is not metal, which is strong and it's far lighter in weight. So one example is something called carbon fiber.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you can work out why that's important for going into space.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's hard getting into space because of Earth's gravity. Earth's gravity keeps pulling us down. So if you launch a rocket into space, Earth's gravity is always trying to pull it back down to Earth. So if it's far lighter, then it's far easier for the rocket actually to reach space.
Yeah, definitely. Like mobile phones that you used to have, they used to be like really like thick ones, to like really heavy ones. But nowadays it feels really, well, not heavy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yes. Actually, just think about the technologies we're using for this conversation, Jack. Now, if we were trying to do this, say, 30 years ago, maybe even less, we would need a television studio. Okay, so in other words, we are using something that just didn't exist a few years ago. It would have been much bigger. The computers, the camera, you'd have needed a whole room for all the equipment, at least.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Now we've already got like tripods and like microphones, mouses and stuff like that, and green screens, but you would have used loads of other technology and it would have been much more complicated.
Yes.
Actually, less complicated than engineering, but more complicated in the amount of things you need to have.
And you'd need more people. So there's three of us doing this, whereas 30 years ago, you'd have needed many more people to let this sort of conversation happen. It's an amazing world.
Yeah, it is. I can't even imagine what it'd be like in the future. I think that's a bit a step too far, but... Do you think there's any way that space travel in the future could be better from the environment, like the fuel or the materials the rocket's made from?
Yes, there are cleaner fuels which can be used, and some rockets do use them. They produce less pollution, they're cleaner. So I think it's quite likely that there will be more of those. The materials, we've already talked about metal being heavy, and of course it's precious, you know, we need to recycle it when we can. I think one of the big differences that might happen is that more and more rockets will be used more than once.
Yeah.
You probably know that one of the companies launching rockets is called SpaceX.
Yes, I
know. You know SpaceX?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they can now reuse their rockets. And I think that's going to be more common. And they will certainly come back down to Earth rather than littering up space. Space is getting a little bit congested. It's getting quite busy. So we need to think of ways in which we can remove the rubbish or not create the rubbish in the first place. So it's just like litter here on Earth. You know, we don't like litter. So how can we, A, stop litter being dropped in the first place? And then B, how can we make sure that litter that is there can be collected and picked up?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Because, well, the thing is that space is very big. And obviously, it's not a good thing to do it. But unfortunately, we don't have the technology to actually get into the other space of space and do things there and try to remove the rubbish.
I think there is hope, actually, Jack, because first of all, it's everyone who is involved in space. They need to talk to each other, you know, have meetings and agree ways in which space debris can be kept to the barest minimum. And then there are actually ways in which you can clear up rubbish in space. It needs to be developed, but it can be done. And I think we'll see a lot more of that.
My sister's preschool organised a community litter pick. So we need the same sort of thing, but in space.
Yeah. You can really let your imagination go. Let's say there's a satellite that doesn't work anymore in space. So it's floating around there, causing a nuisance. So I bet you could come up with some really good ideas as to how we would collect it. How would we bring it back down to Earth?
I'm not really sure. I think we could just get like a giant robot litter picker that could just use sensors and stuff like that to find its way across space and then grab huge bits, put it in like a container and maybe the back of it, and then like collect more and then empty that container back into like the main, like a dump truck for space. That's an idea.
That's right. Yeah.
We need something that would attract carbon fiber, like a magnet, but not a magnet. Then it could suck it all up.
Yeah.
Like a massive Hoover, except that I might suck that.
Or a net, perhaps.
Yeah.
If you could throw a net over the satellite, then you pull it in like that.
Yeah, that would work. There is a sci-fi video that NASA made called Visions of the Future, and it shows holiday destinations in space, like an observation deck on Venus that looks like a giant ice cream cone. There is a model of a deck chair on Mars at the Science Museum.
Yep, I know the one you mean, Jack.
I saw it online. I've been to the space exhibit, but it was a really long time ago. Like a little model with a deck chair on the surface of fake Mars. It's called a diorama, isn't it?
Yeah, space tourism.
Do you think holidays in space in the future will exist?
Holidays in space? Well, it's already happening, actually. The problem for us, for you, your family, me, my family, is that in order to have a holiday in space, probably on a space station, you need to be very, 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 very rich. So at the moment, most people cannot afford to do that. So maybe in the future, there'll be more holidays in space, but I think it's going to be a long way off. But certainly the moon is only 2.5 days away.
Yes.
So if you were to get in your space rocket, like the astronauts did, that's okay. Mars is going to be harder. Now, that little display in the Science Museum, part of it's a joke, but it's really asking a question. Next time you're in the museum, if you look at the photograph, look very carefully, and you'll see next to the deck chair is a bottle of sun cream, but it's a very, very high-grade one, because actually Mars is not a very nice place. You'd have to stay in your spacesuit. You couldn't go for a nice walk in the open air, because there is no air that we can breathe. And it's very cold, very, very, very cold indeed. So maybe we'll have holidays there one day, but they won't be like holidays that we have here on Earth. But the adventure would be amazing. So if you're into adventure holidays, then yeah, maybe one day.
Yeah, that would be so cool. I understand what you mean by it. If you had sun cream on, you'd obviously have to take your suit off to put the sun cream on, but then you can't actually put it on because you don't have air to breathe.
That's right.
And also, there's like a bucket and spade where they like digged up the sand, which is...
Yes.
Sort of a joke, yeah.
But it's just to make people think about what they're looking at.
You have a film about life on the International Space Station at the museum. In 2031, the existing space station will be removed and new commercial ones will be put up there. Some will be owned by private companies. What do you think about that?
Again, it's already happening. So there are parts of the International Space Station, that's the one that's orbiting Earth over our heads. I hope you've looked at it. I hope you've seen it on a nice clear night. Have you ever seen it go overhead?
I don't think so. I saw him flying. I do remember seeing that.
Sorry, my mum said that I actually have. One Christmas Eve, we saw it at the same time as Father Christmas flying overhead on his sleigh.
Excellent.
I've done some research and apparently it's the third brightest object in the sky.
Yeah. You know NASA, of course. NASA is the most famous space agency, American. And their long-term plan is to let private companies look after space stations, reaching space stations, taking astronauts up to a space station, bringing them back down to Earth, leaving NASA to concentrate on going further out into space. So that will be going back to the moon and onto Mars. I have a few concerns. Private companies, they need to be regulated properly and carefully, because companies very often are in the business of making money, which is fine, you know, that's fair enough. But if there is too much concentration on making money and mistakes start to happen with the rest of the planning, then that can become dangerous or unwanted. We need to make sure that everyone is in agreement as to what rules they should follow. So it's really like going to school. There are lots of rules, many of which you don't even notice. But if there were no rules, it would be chaos. So going to space, there need to be rules. One of the concerns is actually thinking about the moon and thinking about when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon and the 10 other astronauts who walked on the moon. Where they landed on the moon, those landing sites are very, very important. And they are still pretty much as they were left 50 years ago. So I would have thought we need to make sure that we protect those landing sites so we don't have people just walking all over them.
Yeah, definitely, because if there wasn't rules, I don't have to explain this, but
I watched a video about it and the astronaut who was talking said he thought it was a good thing because we could learn more about space and share ideas. But I guess that would have to be one of the rules, that they shared their knowledge with NASA, otherwise it would just be a bit selfish.
Yes, that's right. That's a very good point. Yeah. It is a really good question, Jack.
Thank you.
When the space station comes down, will you be able to have any parts of it in the museum, or does most of it burn away as it re-enters the atmosphere?
Oh, you'd make a good curator. So we've actually thought about that. There's a place in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which is called Point Nemo.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the notional target when you're deorbiting a space station. You aim for the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the hope being that that's the least chance of actually hitting anyone. Now, the space station is huge, so almost certainly bits of the space station will survive re-entry.
They've been 3D printing tools, growing vegetables, and even sequencing DNA on the International Space Station. What do you think is next for science on the space station?
Okay. On the space station, well, of course, as you quite rightly say, the International Space Station is coming towards the end of its life. So it should last a few more years. I think hopefully it will still be working until then. And then there'll be others. So it may be a question of what goes on in space stations in the future. And I think there will be more ambitious types of science done. You probably know that you can make things in space that you can't make on Earth because we have gravity. So if we're mixing two metals together, then on Earth, you kind of don't get a pure mix. It's like when you're cooking or something like that, you have to add more than one ingredient. You have to mix them up properly. You have to really whisk hard, don't you?
Yeah.
So when you're making a fancy metal out of two metals on Earth, gravity gets in the way. Whereas on a space station, then the effect of gravity is cancelled out, which means you're able to get a far purer combination. So I can see more of that happening. I think also it will be very important about understanding ourselves, the human body, and how it reacts to being in space. Because we are the way we are because of Earth. We're the shape we are. We can do what we do because of Earth. We were not designed. We didn't evolve for Mars. So when we go to Mars, we have to really be clever and try and fool Mars into thinking that we were. So that means that we have to do all sorts of things to make sure that we can survive on Mars. I think on the space stations in the future, there'll be a lot more science about how humans can truly live and work in space for long periods of time. Because at the moment, we have to come up with some very expensive inventions so that we can carry on living in space. Did you sneeze just then? Because that made me think of something else, actually. Someone asked the other day, what does an astronaut do when they want to scratch their nose? And I don't know the answer to that. You've got your helmet on, you've got an itchy nose, you know, and you want to do that. Yeah. But you can't. You can't touch it. I'll have to ask a few astronauts.
I think you probably have to go inside, then take your helmet off, and then scratch your nose.
That could take a long time.
Yeah.
So imagine you're doing a spacewalk. You've got your spacesuit on. You're floating in space.
Yeah.
Or something in your eye.
Yes.
Get a windscreen wipe on. Use onion juice, squeeze it all over it, and then it makes your eyes water.
But you couldn't open your visor. You could have something that you could squeeze in your hand and it would squirt
inside of it.
Yeah.
inside your helmet. There's another invention for me to work on.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on my podcast today, Doug. My favourite part is when we talked about this last question, actually.
Yes.
What sort of science there will be in the future.
It's a great pleasure, Jack, and thank you for asking me. And I look forward to maybe seeing you at the Science Museum one day.
Yeah, thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I've learned so much from this week's episode. My mum will put a link in the podcast description to NASA's Holidays of the Future video, and she'll also post on social media photos of some exhibits that Doug talked about through the London Science Museum. So as you've heard, developments in spacecraft and space technology possibly will make the future of space travel for people like you and me much more practical. If it's a bit cheaper, of course. The possibility of more people travelling to space in the future isn't going to happen quickly though. Scientists and engineers are going to have to work really hard to make it safe, green, and affordable for people. Of course, exploring new planets sounds scary. It's different. It's new. If it did happen, it could change our lives forever and even the way that humans evolve in the future. I'd definitely like the chance to visit another planet, but I don't think I want to live there. How about you? To be honest, I don't think we're looking after the planet we're already living on very well. So before we think about going anywhere else, I think we need to make the effort to save this one first.
Go Team Earth!
Join me next time for another exciting episode of Jack to the Future.